Okay, thanks to the organizers for inviting me. Before I start, I just wanted to express my great disappointment in all of you for being here. There's a great talk by John Preskill right now that you're all missing. And so, anyway, if you guys want to leave, you can go. It's recorded and you can watch mine later. But since you're here, I'll give the talk anyway. But again, greatly disappointed. Okay, so I'm going to talk about signatures of light relics. This is trying to stay in the theme of this conference, which is not about inflation. And so I'm talking about stuff that happened after inflation. It's based on a number of papers I've written with various collaborators over the past few years. Most of these names you probably know. I would like to highlight Ben Walish, who was a student when we started working together and now is a postdoc at the IAS and UC San Diego, who has really led a lot of these projects. So of all the names, I want to make sure you at least notice that one. Okay, so it's been noticed by many people in this workshop already that we only have access directly to part of the history of the universe, everything after about 380,000 years, and that leaves this whole interesting period when lots of cool stuff can happen and we'd like to know more about, not amenable to direct observations, at least with light. This, on the previous slide, was maybe not, didn't seem so dramatic, but when expressed, again, many people pointed this out, when expressed in terms of the range of energies we don't have access to, it's much more dramatic. The reheat temperature could have been as high as 10 to the 15 GeV, and all we need is that it's as low as above 10 MeV, and so that leaves something like 17 orders of magnitude in energy that we have no direct access to, at least, again, with light, or with neutrinos as well. So why does it matter that we can't see what's going on in the early universe? Well, part of it is that cosmology is so directly tied to more or less all the significant problems in physics. It's the source of big problems like cosmological constant problem, the origin of dark matter, but it even plays a role in problems that are not obviously cosmological, like the strong CP problem, attempts to solve the hierarchy problem, and a variety of other ideas, including the obviously cosmological ones like the origin of structure, baryogenesis, magnetic fields, etc. The reason this matters is that when you look at actual individual models to solve this problem, they often change the history in the past. They try to find some way to change this past history, and often solutions to these individual problems are not even self-consistent with the past history. So one solution might change something at one time, demand a low reheat temperature, while another one needs a high reheat temperature. And because we don't know what's happening, we can sort of hold all these ideas in our mind as being self-consistent, while the individual solutions may not be. So my goal is to try to shed light on some of the early universe through light particles. So we'll focus on two particular strategies. One is the cosmic neutrino background. Many people have commented on how this is very well measured, and I'm going to talk about how well it's measured and how well we know it from cosmology. And then I'll also talk about the possibility that new additional particles, light particles, were created at earlier times. I'll focus on thermal relics, but this also includes things like gravitational waves that many people have mentioned that would also contribute relativistic energy densities. Okay, and these are important, again, because if I just went through that list, and we just go through which of these ideas have often involved things that would change the number of light degrees of freedom, a significant subset incorporate new light particles that would be probed by these kinds of considerations. So all of these things sort of start with cosmic neutrinos. They're the canonical example of a light relic. Cosmic neutrinos start out in thermal equilibrium at high temperatures, but because of the nature of the weak interactions, the production rate drops off very quickly with temperature compared to the expansion rate. And so they start to decouple at sort of order MeV, and they decouple between MeV and 100 keV. If that was all that happened, then the temperature of neutrinos would be the same as the temperature of photons, even though they decouple. But the decoupling temperature happens before at temperatures above the electron mass. And so as the universe drops, the temperature drops below the electron mass, the conservation of co-moving entropy moves the entropy that was stored in electrons into photons and heats the photons relative to the neutrinos, leaving this characteristic ratio of temperatures cubed of this famous factor of 11 force. Now, in most cosmological measurements, the dominant thing we're sensitive to is the energy density in neutrinos. But that energy density in neutrinos is often converted into this number n effective, which is just the ratio of these energy density neutrinos to energy density in photons, multiplied by some constants that are conveniently chosen so that in the standard model, if there was perfect decoupling of neutrinos, it would be exactly 3. The reality is that there's not perfect decoupling. There's still some finite production of neutrinos from electron-positron annihilation. Plus, there's some QED plasma corrections. And in the end, you get a number that's corrected by about 1%, so that the ineffective prediction of the standard model is 3.045, which sounds like a funny number if you interpret it as a number of neutrino species, but it's just a way of writing the energy density in neutrinos.
Has this changed recently? When used to be
046? Yeah, this one here. Again, within, I mean, the error bars are kind of consistent. The error bar is really on that last decimal place. So you don't know if it's 4.6 or 4.5. It's somewhere in there.
It's plus minus 0.0.
The previous one was bigger than that. The previous one was more like 5 in the third digit. But again, I mean, none of these things is perfect. But again, at the level we're talking about, these things are all the same. Yes. But no, you're right. It has changed. The typical one is quoted as 4.6, and that there was already an error on that 4.6. Yeah, you should have, yeah. Yeah, that's right. This is the most recent one, this 2016 paper. Okay, so if there were, the universe was hot, and if there were additional light particles, they would also be produced thermally, and or could be produced thermally, and those will also contribute to ineffective. So in particular, any light thermalized particle that free streams, so it doesn't have self-interactions that make it into a fluid, will look like a neutrino cosmologically. And so at the end of the day, we can just group it into ineffective. Now, if that thing was produced in thermal equilibrium but decoupled at some temperature T sub f, then the prediction for how much it contributes to ineffective is actually a universal function of the number of the temperature TF and the number of degrees of freedom associated with this particle. And the reason is that under the assumption of a standard model plus light particles, what dilutes it is just the same thing that happens to the neutrinos. It's just the number of degrees of freedom whose mass is below the temperature at which this particle decoupled and above the mass of the electron, and those things just convert their entropy into photons and thus dilute the energy density. So it's just this universal function, this G star, which is the number of degrees of freedom in the standard model, that suppresses ineffective. So you get these universal looking curves for the contribution to ineffective as a function of the freeze-out temperature, which is just a mirror of the number of degrees of freedom in the standard model as a function of temperature. And then these different lines are just rescaled by the number of degrees of freedom of individual particles. Here is these lines are pretty faint. This here is the constraint from Planck. And then this region here is the QCD phase transition. So current constraints for sort of individual particles, so 1, fermion, boson, et cetera, is sort of at the QCD phase transition. So things that decoupled after QCD phase transition are currently excluded, excluded by Planck. Now, there's a lot of ongoing measurements of the cosmic microwave background. There's work at the South Pole by, for example, BICEP and SBT. There's projects going on in the Atacama Desert, like Polar Bear and ACT. And then there's these upcoming projects, Simons Observatory, CMBS4, and potentially PICO, that are various stages of development. At the same time, we're trying to probe the interior volume of the universe with galaxy surveys. So the Sloan Digital Sky Survey has really pioneered this, looking at large numbers of galaxies out to redshift of sort of order 1. And again, there's a variety of experiments coming online this decade that are going to map the universe out to higher redshift and in higher resolution. And so roughly the landscape looks something like this. The next decade, there's all kinds of projects coming online that all together should help inform us about what was going on in the early universe. Okay, so and sort of to give a rough picture of where we're going, the next generation CMB, so next generation means the next 10 years, is hoping to get down to this 9, which is to exclude delta N effective of 0.06 at 2 sigma. That is enough to rule out things at sort of 100 GeV freeze-out temperatures for individual particles, so a Majorana fermion or one massless vector. The nicest thing about these curves is that they saturate, so that in principle, if it was just the standard model, they could go all the way out to the reheat temperature. And so a big picture goal would be to reach this line of 0.027, which means that you could probe any individual particle that froze out at any temperature below the reheat temperature.
The next generation, you mean like CMBS-4?
CMBS-4.
So you don't mean stuff that's on the sky now?
No. I mean, okay, those are on the sky now are this generation.
Okay, good.
So S4 is next generation, so, yes. But this is next decade.
SDG3,
no, they'll be up here by some amount. Okay, so let's talk about the CMB. Okay, so the cosmic microwave background, as you all know, is made up of sort of five individual pieces. There's protons, electrons, photons, neutrinos, and dark matter. These three here basically form a relativistic fluid prior to recombination, and then they couple to gravity to neutrinos and dark matter that are doing their own thing. When we look at the cosmic microwave background, we're seeing a snapshot of the sound waves in this relativistic fluid. So this is just a picture of a bunch of sound waves bouncing around in the early universe. What makes the cosmic microwave background and cosmology in general a really powerful probe of and effective is that a lot of the modes entered the universe in the era of radiation domination. And radiation domination, the energy density is 41% energy in neutrinos. So when you look at it, when you consider gravitational effects that contribute to the behavior of these modes, 41% of that gravitational effect is coming from neutrinos. So it's not a small thing you're looking for. The cosmic neutrino background is an order one contribution to what's going on in this regime. So the dominant way that we constrain an effective in the cosmic microwave background is through the effect of on the damping tail. So in particular, this damping tail, this exponential suppression as you go to high L, is really a diffusion process. So what's happening is the photons are they're randomly walking out of the overdensities because of their finite mean free path, and random walks are sort of linear in time. So what you're seeing here is that there's the relevant time scale is Hubble, and so the amount of diffusion is just how long this random walk had to operate. Now, because neutrinos contribute 41% of the expansion rate, you're really just measuring that contribution to the expansion rate by measuring how much diffusion has happened. And so this is a relatively large effect, which is why it gives such good constraints. So for example, right now it's constrained at the sort of 5% level using all of the Planck data available. And again, that gets us to things that are ruled out at sort of freeze out at the QCD phase transition level. Looking forward, using, again, dominated because of this damping tail, constraints from CMBS4 are looking to get down to sort of individual particles of spin 1/2 or 1, freeze out at sort of 100 GeV level. SO is sort of a little bit lower for individuals, sort of order GeV. But all of these CMB experiments driven by this damping tail are pushing down these numbers over the next decade. Now, the rest of the focus for the CMB, I want to focus on an additional effect that's particularly robust to neutrinos, which is their effect on the individual peak locations. So neutrinos do this thing, which is to shift the individual peaks by a constant amount. And this is unique to neutrinos. Nothing else that contributes to the CMB has the same constant shift. And that's particularly compelling because one of the things in cosmology is you like to know when the thing you measured is robust to generalization, so expanding the number of parameters, and when it's just an artifact of the limitations of your model. So why is this peak? Why are these peak positions so unique to neutrinos? Well, it really just comes down to causality. So when we look at this picture, these three things are traveling at different speeds. Dark matter is not going anywhere. It has effective velocity zero because it's cold. There's this relativistic fluid that has sound waves that propagate at 1/√3 the speed of light. But these neutrinos they're not waves, they're just particles, and they travel at the speed of light because they're effectively massless. So what happens is, so you imagine what's going on if you put a delta function perturbation and watched it evolve, you perturb all these things at some origin. The dark matter doesn't move, so it just sits there and doesn't do anything. Meanwhile, there'll be a sphere of expanding sound waves that travels at 1/√3 the speed of light. But the neutrinos travel ahead of those sound waves. So they get ahead and they propagate information faster than is allowed by the sound horizon. So the neutrinos are the unique thing in cosmology that's able to propagate effects that would have been considered acausally forbidden if you thought only sound waves are able to communicate information. Now this shows up in these phases for somewhat complicated reasons, But roughly speaking, what's going on in these sound waves is that you just have the sound, and then you have the coupling to gravity. So if there's no coupling to gravity, because of the super horizon nature of the initial conditions, the phase of all of these waves is completely fixed. It's a pure cosine. However, the coupling to gravity can reintroduce the sine under special conditions. So in particular, this coupling of gravity can introduce a term, but only when the speed of propagation is faster than the speed of the sound waves. So in particular, if you're... Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt you, but just for clarity, that all this is assuming adiabatic initial conditions.
Yes, adiabatic initial conditions. Yeah, yes, isocurvature can change the phase, but it will also do other things. So the isocurvature is usually not going to just contribute to a phase, so it's not a particular concern. But yes, this picture, even going back here, this picture would be different because I perturbed them all in the same spot as a delta function to determine the transfer function. If I had isocurvature, it would just be like two things at different points, for example. Okay, so just as a demonstration, you can check that it's just a property of propagation speeds, that if you can absorb this sine into a phase, and this phase is zero if you add a fluid that travels slower than the speed of sound, and then it becomes non-zero. And again, it's just this property of causality. This phase is what's telling you about the information traveling ahead or behind the sound waves. And you can use this effect to actually measure the cosmic neutrino background. So this was beautifully done first by Follin et al., where they really took this template and they shifted all of the modes while marginalizing over all of lambda CDM, and they got this measurement using just the Planck TT data. We and also Yanou and company did something effectively the same but a little bit easier, which is just to marginalize over things that change everything but the phase shift. But this is using the full Planck temperature and polarization data, which is why this measurement here gives smaller error bars. But both of them are consistent with sort of 10 sigma evidence for cosmic neutrinos just coming from this phase shift. So really robust to all of the possible changes to the model.
Can I ask you a question about your previous slide?
Yeah.
So why does that phase not go negative when the neutrino sound speed drops below CS? I mean, if it's encoding causality, why don't you just get...
No, so it goes...
Yeah, why does it go to zero?
So this is really, like, if you calculate the way this thing is calculated, it's a contour integral, and it's zero when it's just like literally zero, and then when the speed of propagation is faster, the contour at infinity is no longer zero. So it's one of these things. It's like the difference of the two speeds in a contour integral, and then when it crosses, when this thing flips sign, you can't close the contour to get zero anymore, and you get non-zero. So it's just zero here by some contour integral argument. I mean, I don't know if that's helpful. It's really causality. Like, there's a real space way of picturing it where it's literally causality.
When I switched the two, I didn't just get an opposite phase shift that went the other way.
No, it's the same as like Green's functions, right? Like, when you calculate when you go from real Fourier space to real space with a Green's function, it's like if it's analytic in the upper half plane, you get zero until the thing flips.
I'm just trying to understand. Yeah.
But it's really what it is if you looked at the shape in real space, it's like a 1/1, I'll get to this later, it's really traveling ahead of the sound wave. So if you look at the propagation, Fourier transform this cosine, it's like a delta, it stops, it's zero for all distances greater than the sound horizon, and the Fourier transform of the sine is like something that continues on. And so it just, in real space, it's obvious that like you really have to be going faster to change what's going on ahead. Okay, so that's where we are with the phase shift in the CMB. Now I want to talk about what we can learn from the large-scale structure surveys. Okay, so again, lots of things going on in large-scale structure, lots of cool things, mapping the universe in huge volumes. The main thing you would take away from these surveys is the matter-power spectrum. The main effective on the matter-power spectrum is to change matter radiation equality, which is not a particularly robust thing to go measuring. And in general, the biggest changes to the matter-power spectrum are all relatively smooth functions of K, which is a problem because on top of this, there's all kinds of nonlinear effects, which also contribute smooth functions of K. So in particular, when you do forecasts, there's all kinds of ways to add these are all free parameters associated with modeling the nonlinearities, and you can see that the forecasts are strongly dependent on how I model the nonlinearities. So while it's possible, and obviously work in progress, to try to measure an effect of using this broadband information, it's very sensitive to nonlinearities, which is a problem not present in the CMB. And this is a main obstacle to really trusting the forecast right now for what you can do using the broadband. However, I've already talked about the phase shift, and so we're going to go in that direction. And this is already what, to some degree, what these large-scale structure surveys are doing, because the main science return from the large-scale structure surveys is typically the BAO. So the BAO is the relic of that sound wave that survives into the distribution of matter. So if we go back to that picture, we have these sound waves propagating out in a spherical shell. And before recombination, they're just one thing. It's the baryons and the photons, or this fluid. But then after recombination, neutral hydrogen forms, and the photons can't support they don't provide pressure for the baryons anymore, and the baryons get frozen. They get stuck because nothing's pushing them anymore. So they pile up at a distance, which is roughly the sound horizon at the time of recombination, and they make a big bump. And that bump grows under gravity and ultimately sucks in the dark matter as well. And so you get this frozen peak in the matter power spectrum. Now, if you Fourier transform that peak, it looks like, as you'd imagine, it's like the CMB is the Fourier transform of the same peak. You get a bunch of oscillations in the matter power spectrum. But because the baryons are only a few percent or a small fraction of the dark matter, and for other reasons, you end up with a sort of 5% oscillation. So you can barely see it when I plot the data here, and you have to zoom in to see that there's really this wiggle on top of the matter power spectrum. But this is exactly what BOSS is designed to look for, is to isolate this wiggle. Now, from my previous description, you should not be surprised that this wiggle itself has a phase shift that's characteristic of the neutrinos. It's the same phenomena again. It's just now it's propagated to large-scale structure. There's a tail ahead of the sound horizon due to these neutrinos, which shifts the locations of the BAO, the peaks of in the BAO in frequency in Fourier space. Now, again, there's the complications of nonlinear evolution. For the BAO, this nonlinear evolution, so this is what it will look like in linear theory, but there's all these nonlinear effects due to gravity that move this thing around, but it's roughly known how to restore this for just the location of the BAO peak, which is used as a standard ruler. It turns out that you might worry that the phase shift would not have any nice properties with regards compared to, say, the location of this peak, but it actually turns out to be the opposite. This thing that makes the phase shift special actually makes it protected from nonlinear effects. So I won't go through the full argument, but roughly speaking, if you were to imagine the BAO as a delta function at some particular radius, then the phase shift corresponds to a tail that goes out beyond, but blows up as you approach the BAO scale from R's greater than RS. Now, you might worry that gravity being a long-range force could induce something that lives at larger distances, but you know that if I have a spherical shell in gravity, it doesn't know about the radius of the shell. The force of gravity is the same as if you put all the matter at the origin. So gravity can't make something that looks like a function that's blowing up at RS because it just falls off like 1 over R. And roughly speaking, that's the origin of the fact that gravity can't change the phase shift. But since the phase shift is predicted, now the natural thing to ask is, can we see it in data? So what we set out to do was to try to measure it in the most recent data release, BOSS data release 12, which is just a measurement of 1.2 million galaxies on 10,000 square degrees of the sky out to redshift 0.75. So in this case, we did the analysis just like the Folin et al. Paper, but now applied to the BAO. We construct a template for this phase shift because it's a k-dependent, because it asymptotes to a constant, but there's some at low k, it has some kind of shape. So we model this as a function of k with some amplitude that we want to measure. And so this amplitude is normalized, so the amplitude is 0 if there's no neutrinos, and 1 if it's the standard model value. So beta of 1 is the standard model, beta of 0 is no neutrinos, and we want to see if we can measure beta. And so to save you the details in the interest of time, this is what we get by looking at this BAO power spectrum. We get evidence for the phase shift at 99.5% confidence, although the measured value is somewhat larger than one. It's consistent with one, but at two sigma, but it's apparently fluctuated up from our perspective. But we rule out zero at 95% confidence. We've checked a variety of possible concerns, including systematics and robustness to various cosmological parameters, and this measurement seems robust. Again, the error bars are relatively large, but it's roughly 2.5 to 3 sigma evidence for a non-zero phase shift. Looking forward, if we just take the error bar, where BOSS is up here, where again, one is the difference between n effective of 3 and n effective of 0, and we're looking for DESI and Euclid. DESI has already taken first light. DESI's taking data now. Euclid will hopefully launch soon. We'll get down to the point to maybe see this at 5 sigma, 4 or 5 sigma. Okay, in the last few minutes, I wanted to advertise some potential applications of this analysis beyond just cosmic neutrinos. So what really made this analysis of large-scale structure data powerful was that things that wiggle are easy to tell apart from nonlinear effects. At first order, that's all we were doing. Wiggles, either of the BAO variety or the phase shift variety, they're all, you know, they're just really hard to generate that from local gravitational evolution. Now, there are lots of other things that make wiggles. So, for example, you can make wiggles in the power spectrum from inflation, things like axion monodromy inflation, for example. But it's also known there's things like dark acoustic oscillations, dark radiation, drag between dark matter and dark radiation. These can produce additional features in the power spectrum. Yep?
It's a really cool measurement. I'm also curious, do you know models that would produce no phase shift here, but have, in fact, let's go up the patient and everything else?
No. So building models that would take advantage of this is something that we're looking into. But for us, for now, it's just this is a further piece of evidence that the lambda CDM is correct. But yeah, that particularly would be interesting. The physics around the decoupling of baryons and photons is where you could imagine getting something interesting happening. So we're looking into whether there's ways to change that decoupling period in such a way that would, because the CMB visibility function is actually very different than the decoupling that's relevant for the BAO. So actually the BAO scale and the scale from the CMB are different because of that evolution that differs. So that's kind of the obvious place to start, but we haven't looked into this at all. So many people in this room have probably written models that have some kind of crazy thing going on in the power spectrum, and this is something that you can look for in the data. And I'd like to emphasize why this is a good idea by pointing out the difference between our ineffective analyses. So the CMB, these wiggles are an order one effect. I mean, the CMB is all wiggles in a certain sense. And we measured this phase shift at 10 sigma. The BAO in large-scale structure is a 5% effect. It's a tiny wiggle on top of a huge signal, but we get a phase shift measurement at 2 to 3 sigma. So you pay a factor of 20 up front in terms of the size of the signal, but you only pay a factor of say 4 or 5 in the measurement of the phase shift. So just from this observation, that should tell you that if you were looking at something that was living in the dark matter itself and not restricted only to the baryons, you wouldn't have to pay this factor of 20, and you might have more signal to work with. So that was the main idea, was to look for wiggles here. And so again, just from this picture, this is a 5% wiggle. Say, what if I had a 10% wiggle, I would just see it by eye. So obviously, if I just start putting in oscillations in the matter power spectrum, I would see them really clearly just taking existing data. So we decided to look at these sort of two canonical things you get from inflation, but again, they're like things you can get from stuff in the later universe. So these are just linear oscillations in K and log oscillations in K, which one's which? Log, linear, in K. And we just look to see if there's evidence for this in the data. So it's really as simple as just putting it on top of this and asking whether the data permits it. And here's the results. So this is Planck's constraint on the same exact scales. This is right, should be in Planck's wheelhouse. So this is using all of the Planck data. It's in a regime where it should be very sensitive. And this is BOSS DR12. So we're getting up to factors of 2 or 3 improvement over Planck by using large-scale structure data. And this is, again, this is predictable based on that fact that we paid a factor of 20 and didn't lose that in the signal, and that's why we're doing so well here, because we're not paying a factor of 20, and so we're getting a lot more signal to noise. So here I cheated, and this is log. So this is like, this is some dimensionless number associated with log oscillations. So this is what 30 would look like in that plot. Yeah, it's a dimensionless number because of the log oscillations.
Yeah,
there's a,
I'm just trying to understand what is the corresponding to my delta L.
Yeah, so it's like a, so for log of k is 30 oscillations. So I change one decade of k, one e of k, I get 30 oscillations. That's what 30 would be here. So that would be like here. And this bump here is the BAO. So you're degenerate with the BAO around here. And that's why this, that's why you lose out around here, because you're marginalizing over the BAO. Okay, looking forward, this will get a lot better in large-scale structure. So this dashed line here is a cosmic variance CMB experiment, so better than any experiment you can actually do. This is DESI, which is taking data now, will exceed a cosmic variance limited CMB experiment by a significant fraction. There are proposals for this line. This is a 21 centimeter intensity mapping proposal called PUMA that again is now down to sort of parts in 10 to the minus 4. And so it's really plausible that you could use large-scale structure to really dig deep into these oscillation signatures. And again, if you're interested in anything that puts an oscillation in the matter-power spectrum, you could imagine that you would gain similar sensitivity in the future of large-scale structure. Okay, so I think I'm out of time. So to summarize, we know the cosmic neutrino background exists. It's a nice probe of the earliest moments that we can access right now. We see it in the damping tail at 30 sigma, we see it in the phase shift at 10 sigma, and we see it in the BAO at sort of 2 to 3 sigma. These measurements are incredibly powerful and can be used to test for new light particles that could probe all the way back to reheating. And these new, some of these things also motivate new types of analyses that could shed light on all kinds of interesting particle physics. Okay, thank you.
Okay, question for Dan.
No, they're pretty. It's degenerate with neutrinos, neutrino mass, given the current constraints on neutrino mass. So the neutrino mass is, right now, constraints are such that the neutrinos were relativistic at sort of temperatures of an EV where all of this stuff is happening. And so this stuff is getting imprinted into the photons baryons at that time, and then it just lives in the photons baryons. What the neutrinos do later is irrelevant. They go away. Neutrino mass is obviously a very interesting measurement in the later universe for other reasons, but the neutrino mass and the impact on the CMB is only if the neutrino masses were like EV-ish, where so they're up at the point where it changes the dynamics of neutrinos at the time before recombination in particular. So given current constraints, and that's part of why we can constrain the mass of well with the CMB down to sort of 0.5-ish EV. Does that make sense, or?
Well, it seems like your power spectrum suppression on small scales, that would be degenerate.
Yeah, so power spectrum suppression, So the wiggles, that's why wiggles are great, right? Because power spectrum suppression, that's degenerate with everything, right? Like that you get all kinds of nonlinear effects, you have biasing. So it's really hard to do that in the nonlinear regime. But that's what's nice here is that because it's something imprinted in this oscillation, it's robust to all of that kind of mess. And so they're totally degenerate, they're not degenerate at that level.
More questions?
So I just want to ask about the previous plot you had. So A lin, what is this? This is just the amplitude of the...
This is the amplitude of the linear.
Of the linear
this
part
is,
of the
I mean, it does, this, you'd have the same plot for either one. This is just the amplitude of the oscillation.
Okay.
So our the Boss constraint is up here, like a few percent.
So this is, right, so this is like 10% of the 10 to the minus 9 and the...
Yeah, so this is like 2% of the amplitude of the power spectrum.
Yeah, okay.
So, right, so this is 10 to the minus 11-ish.
Yeah, no, that's what I was asking.
This is Planck, And then again, this is DESI, which is taking data now, right? So there's just a huge jump from where we are now. So yeah, to put it into scale, we're getting sub percent pretty quickly.
And the second thing I want to ask you is about these models where people put in strong interactions for neutrinos. And so does this say, do you have anything to say about those? Okay, that's a sigh, which.
Yes, in principle, those things should be excluded. When you put in strong enough interactions, they're inconsistent with the analyses we've done to do the phase shift. Now, the authors of some of those papers, when they look only at TT data, would claim that the TT data is consistent with having a large interaction. When you add polarization, the evidence for those things goes to zero pretty quick, but there's some debate over some tiny island that...
Yeah, there's that weird island they find, which is
Yeah, but the island goes down with polarization data, and so I haven't seen an update. BAO will also interfere with this, but...
Okay,
yeah,
now that's what I wanted to hear.
Yeah, so. I don't know exactly what to make of the tiny island, but with polarization data... So the other thing I didn't mention is that there's this famous fact that peaks are sharper in polarization. So the phase shift is particularly strongly constrained when you have polarization data. So the fact that there's a big difference in this neutrino interactions when you look at TT-only data versus looks at TT plus polarization is not surprising, because the peaks are so sharp in polarization, you get a much better constraint when you add that data.
Other questions?
Because the temperature is the combination. When you look at temperature, it's a combination of there's the usual Sachs-Wolfe, but then you have the Doppler term, right? Because and there's no such Doppler, so they don't interfere at all.
Any other questions?
So let's say you have additional, let's say neutrino, dark neutrino does not couple to a standard model. I guess it will also cause some of the observational result, right? Let's say this neutrino has strong interactions.
Self-interactions?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's a fluid.
Yeah, can be in the fluid limit, so maybe in the between. Can you see those kind of things?
So we've excluded fluids down to, so roughly, if you put a fluid and an effective in,
yeah.
It's consistent with zero fluid at sort of, again, what you'd expect given the ineffective constraint. So the fluid is, well, given the phase shift constraint. So roughly speaking, it's like, it's ruled out at what, off the top of my head, it should be about, you could permit maybe 0.3 ineffective in neutrinos, of fluid-like neutrinos. But it's zero plus or minus 0.2 or something like that is where it is. So it's really, if you put both in, the data strongly prefers. And that's actually how we did the analysis. The lazy version of the CMB analysis is to put in a kind of neutrino that has a phase shift plus a neutrino that doesn't have a phase shift. And so they're totally degenerate at the level of the damping tail, but they're distinguishable by the phase shift. And that's just, it's easier than putting in the template, but they give consistent results.
Yeah, so you talked about neutrino, but if I understand correctly, as far as that the faster one is minimally coupled with gravity, and then it's common, if it propagates faster than 1 over square root 3, then it is minimally coupled with gravity, it's common.
Then
my question is, in that case, the information of the propagation speed of the faster one and the number of the species of the faster one can be captured independently?
So if you have, in principle, and so Planck does an analysis like this, you could put in a speed and you could put in a speed and an energy density and try to constrain the speed. The problem is that the way they do it is like a fluid with a speed, and the fluid is distinguished from this. They're like, the fluid is actually not a good model for neutrinos. And so when they do that analysis, they see evidence for the speed, but they actually, if you took that model and asked how good a fit is it to the data compared to actually modeling the neutrinos correctly, it's like delta chi-squared of like 10 or 15 or something like that. So it's still, like, if you wanted to do that, like, the neutrino mass is probably actually a better version of that analysis, where if it had a mass, they wouldn't travel at the speed of light, and that would interfere with this effect as well.
More questions? Okay, maybe.
Why can't they describe it as a fluid? Is it just the
stresses in that? Or is there a simple one sentence?
Well, in principle, you could try to do it, but it is just the pattern of how that wave moves, right, moves out. So, it just the characteristic way in which information goes from the monopole and dipole through all the higher moments, like that depends on whether you treat it as a fluid. It's just truncating the Boltzmann hierarchy. It's the way they do it. So in principle, you could try to do it this way. And to some degree, the codes like class actually do treat it like a truncated Boltzmann hierarchy, but it really matters how you do it. And the way, when you add these new parameters to try to make a parameter like sound speed to characterize this so that you can measure it, that's truncating in a way that's just not a good representation of the neutrinos given the quality of the data. But in principle, you could try to fix it so that you could still truncate the Boltzmann hierarchy where you're close enough to the neutrinos. So for some particular value of some new parameter, but you can try to measure those parameters. But that hasn't been done correctly, as far as I know.
Okay, maybe I can ask the last question. So I remember a few years ago, there's some moderate uncertainty on the sensitivity of CNBC stage 4 on delta ineffective. So now you're quoting a 2 sigma at 0.6. Is it
yes,
0.06. More certain now?
It is the science driver for the high L observations of CNBS4. So it is a number we have to hit as far as our funding is concerned. So that is what we have set out to do. That is what we said we'd do. And right now the whole experiment is being designed to hit that number. Okay. What was wrong in snowmass, the numbers were quite a bit lower, and that was primarily because they didn't take into account the point sources and temperature at high L. So if you just modeled the whole thing based on the resolution and you measured high LTT out to the L that you have resolution to, then you got a much lower number. But point sources stop you from going to L plus above 3,000. And so if you just put in the point sources and say, I can't go in temperature above 3,000, but I include TE and EE, then you get roughly the S4 numbers. And then we argue about like plus or minus 10 or 20%. But the big jump was that, which was the original forecasts had sort of were way too optimistic on their temperature measurements.
So the 0.6 is more realistic.
0.6 is realistic. Now it has everything. That's including scan strategy. That's including including atmospheric effects. That's the only thing that doesn't. So if I were to say what is the thing that doesn't include that could potentially change that number is beam calibration. So the beam calibration is being investigated to make sure we hit that number, but it's not actually currently included in that forecast. Okay. But everything else is being included, including scan strategy.
The 0.6 is still kind of away from this 0.027, the theory target. I just wonder, do you have any comment if there could be further improvement or it's too futuristic?
So if a really okay, so here we are. So yeah, so this is the dream is to get down to here. Some slightly more doable dream is to get here, so you get to reheating for everything but one single scalar. To get 0.027, this was the motivation for looking at the broadband large-scale structure, and a future survey combined with CNBS4 could potentially get you down there, but you really have to grapple with the nonlinear stuff. So it's possible. Mm-hmm. It's within some kind of realistic forecast. You could get down to 2 sigma for an effect of 0.027, but it requires like, it's either going to take this 21 centimeter PUMA or a spectroscopic follow-up to LSSD. So something like a billion galaxies to redshift of 3. So those are kind of your two strategies. Mm-hmm. Combined with S4 could get you down to this number. But again, you have to do the nonlinear modeling, and that's obviously subject to some uncertainty.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay, so if there's no more questions, let's thank Dan again.